Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And this is Carl Carlson.
And Carl and I, we're just working on our tutorial that we plan to give the RAMS symposium next year, COVID-19 permitting, regarding reliability management. And obviously, whenever we talk about reliability management, a ton of issues come up that are very podcast worthy.
Yeah, we've back and forth a lot of concepts that relate to reliability management. We thought it'd be kind of fun to just share off the top of our head some of the concepts that we're bringing into the body of knowledge of reliability management. Because as I mentioned to Chris just before we hit the record button, this could be a whole series of podcasts because it's just a great subject. It's something that is a lifelong learning process. It's not like learning how to tie your shoes or to do even a model of particular failure mechanism. Once you've got that done, you pretty much have it. But this is something where you can get better and better and better. So I enjoy talking about it. I enjoy listening to other people on the subject. And of course, we'll enjoy hearing from you if you have your thoughts as a listener.
So, Carl, I'm going to put you on the spot. One of the things we just talked about, including in next year's tutorial, was a video by Phil Crosby, who many people know as a leader in the field of quality and realistically reliability too, because he was all about trying to make manufactured products higher quality, which obviously means they last longer when the customer gets them. But we were just looking at that video, and he came up with five or so characteristics of organizations who don't do this sort of stuff well. And realistically, those five characteristics are as relevant today as they have ever been. So when you say you can spend your whole life learning about this sort of stuff, what about the fact that it appears as if there's a really basic body of knowledge which just shouldn't change over time? It's up to us to ignore it or not, I suppose.
Well, yeah, there are underlying philosophies to any subject. And if I could just speak for a minute about my approach to any subject, like reliability management, is to start with the underlying philosophies. And so no matter what subject is, if I'm teaching FMEA or we want to talk about FMEA, I'll get the underlying philosophy. If it's reliability management, the same thing, no matter what the subject is. And so some of the underlying philosophies of reliability management include things like people skills. And so working with people in a positive way, respecting people, encouraging, that's an underlying philosophy that is important. Deming's 14 points. Now, I don't want to go over all 14 of them, but the whole concept of that Deming teaches is an underlying philosophy. One of my most important philosophical points from a management standpoint, and when we're talking reliability management, obviously we have to look at that, is Stephen Covey's factors of success, like begin with the end in mind or sharpen the saw. He had 7 points that he teaches. So I could think about and talk about with you various philosophical points. So let me just bring up one of them. Is I'll take Stephen Covey's begin with the end in mind. I think it's really important when we're looking at the reliability management or quality management to envision what it looks like and to see where do we want to go. So in our five-step process for reliability, we talk about establish the reliability strategic vision as step number one. Start with where you want to go, not just the reliability numbers, not just the reliability characteristics, but organizationally, capability, where are we headed in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. So I think that's a very important step that's an underlying philosophy that makes for good reliability management.
With that strategic vision, Carl, that could be something that's quite easy to say. What are we talking about? Are we talking about a feeling? Are we talking about how the customers perceive us? I mean, I suppose at one basic level, everyone wants to make reliable stuff, but how do we characterize, how to describe our end state, the end we have in mind, in a way that makes sense to all the employees or members of our organization so they know that's where they're heading?
Yeah, great point. So there's going to be two parts to this that are both really important. One is to characterize reliability correctly. So we have the right metrics, we have the right ways to describe it. We're not using MTBF, for example, to characterize our reliability improvements. So you get the right metrics and have the right objectives. This includes understanding the four components of reliability, where we're talking about the ability to achieve or the probability that you can achieve a intended function under certain conditions and have the time element properly described. So all of that is characterizing reliability, describing it in a way that can be achieved. Then there's the additional part of this, which is organizational. It's the people, it's the processes, it's the procedures that you need to have in place. And I want both of those as part of strategic vision. A quick story, Chris. A few years back, I walked into a beverage company. They asked me to do reliability consulting, very well-known, large international beverage company. We're making brand new equipment that they've never done before. And so I sat in with the VP who was in charge of engineering and their staff. And I said, what is your vision for reliability? And they kind of looked at me and they said, well, we don't have a vision for reliability. And so we basically dedicated that time together to talk about where do they want to go? Where do they want to be in a year, 3 years, 5 years? Obviously, they need, their equipment needs to be safe. It needs to be whatever. We need to describe it. And so we set that vision, and then from that we get both the characteristics of reliability properly described, mm-hmm. so we can get the definitions right, but we also get the organizational capability, the procedures, the skills, the people where we want to be as part of that reliability strategic vision. And that was a very interesting discussion, and I learned from that it's not a given. In other words, companies don't automatically know where they want to go. You might have to help them set the goals and set the vision so that then we can walk the path to get there. In fact, from that vision, it goes into the next step, which is the gap assessment, which is a different subject.
And it's worth pointing out that those metrics, they might be the metrics that matter. They might be something the customer clearly asks of you, or they might be something the customer clearly expects, and everyone knows the customer expects. But the reality is you need to go through the full process of trying to understand the customer, trying to put yourself in their shoes. So, for example, you might be interested in service life reliability. You might be interested in warranty reliability, which will definitely be different to your service life reliability. But also, customers take a very dim view of things that fail very, very early in their usage or in their operational life. So you may actually come up with an additional reliability requirement for you and your own team, which in addition to those two is a probability of surviving the first 6 months or things like that. So you really work out what matters to your customer and make sure that gets passed on to your team. Sorry, Carl.
No, that's great. You're absolutely right, because I grew up I started out in aerospace, but then I had a career in vehicle engineering. And so the reliability paradigm that I had from a vehicle engineering standpoint put me into a certain box, if we could look at it conceptually. But there are different boxes, or there's different applications, and that's what you're pointing out. For example, I was on site with a company that was developing rocket bunker buster ordnance. Right. And Let's do a reliability strategic vision. Well, the vision is very different there. It's not like they're worried about, we're going to do this for, we're going to run this rocket for a specific lifetime. They need to know that that particular mission is accomplished, mm-hmm. and that the everything is available and it does what it needs to do in the time that it's meant to do it. But it's not like we're going to, like in vehicles, it's, you know, where you have thousands and millions of vehicles. You essentially have one rocket, one mission. It's kind of like the space shuttle. And so you're going to describe things differently and your metrics might be different. So that vision is very important, and you're absolutely correct. You have to start with the application.
And remember, it's not what you think failure is. It's what your customer thinks failure is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now back at you, Chris. What do you think are one or two of the most important pillars to reliability management?
Okay, I think perhaps the most important thing from my mind is the concept of the vital few. And we talk about this a lot, the vital few versus the trivial thousands. And we don't want to waste time and energy on trying to fix the problem we solved last year, which is what a lot of organizations tend to do if they have at least some reliability success in some initiative or program or what have you. In years gone by, they keep doing the same thing that they used to do, which makes them feel comfortable and safe and warm. But the crux of reliability engineering is an unceasing and unwavering focus on understanding and trying to fix the vital few ways your system can fail. And that requires ongoing curiosity. It requires you to keep searching. By definition, if you remove the weakest point of your design, it ceases being the weakest point of your design, so you need to find the next weakest point of your design. And although this sounds exhaustive, it's actually the reward is that you don't waste your time and energy on the trivial thousands of ways your thing can fail for precious little reward at the end of the day. So you actually invariably save time and money by focusing on those vital few. And obviously when we're talking about the vital few, there's usually one or two or a few of ways that your system will fail that's going to really ruin your day. So the good news story is that using the Pareto principle, 20% of your issues account for 80% of your failures. It's a really valuable and useful approach. The vital few is probably the thing I'd say is the most important. Do you
agree? Totally agree. We had some fun in our, for the listeners here, Chris and I had some fun in our tutorial at RAMS in January, because we made that point about the vital few probably a dozen times in the tutorial, just to make sure it got across to the audience, and they got a kick out of the way we did it. So we did it in a kind of a fun way, but the point is so well taken, and it applies to everything we do in reliability. Reliability is really part of a systems engineering approach. We are one discipline, and that has to be balanced with other performance and marketing and all the other disciplines that go into project management. And so we have to be very clear about how we use resources, and we have to be a team player and understand the priorities of the organization. And we have to know our most important issues, and we have to get the team to participate in identifying the most important issues. And by issues, I mean the things that are necessary to achieve reliability. The wrong way to go about it is to try to do everything. And I've made that mistake many times in my career. I'll just take FMEA, for example. Early in my career, we tried to do FMEAs on everything. And we just went about sort of randomly picking all the parts. And basically, an FMEA had to be done on every design, every change. And we watered down the tool almost to the point of triviality. And so we shifted gears and said, let's prioritize, Chris, like you're saying, let's find the vital few, call them items, subsystems, components, or processes in the manufacturing plant that are the most important. the ones that we absolutely need to nail. And I adopted the philosophy, I'd rather do fewer FMEAs, but do them really well, than do FMEAs on everything and not do them as well because you're stretched for resources. And so that's one application, but it's, I think it's throughout every part of our reliability method management. For example, there's when we did the reliability handbook back part of the SAG 11, we counted upwards of 80 plus reliability methods, and I will guarantee you we do not want to do a reliability plan with 80 methods. So we're going to have to pick the vital few methods that are most important for the vision that you have and based on the gaps in your organization. So those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the ideally you have a really mature team, you have a strategically mature organization. So you're not specifying tools anymore. You're saying, hey, here's a hardware shop full of 80 tools, but your people are trained, they are motivated, they're encouraged to individually always try and find their own vital few, so they'll start understanding what the correct tool for the right time is without us having to say this is what you should and shouldn't use. And it's a slightly different take on what you're saying, Carl, but the principle's the same. You can't do everything. There's a right tool that gets used at the right time and on the right thing for virtually everything. The trick is knowing which tool to use. But when you're talking about I suppose principally, you don't want to do everything. I just recently did a webinar on reliability allocation. I've just written a bunch of articles on Ascendo as well based on that webinar. And for those who are unaware of what reliability allocation is, it's a process you go through where you take a system level reliability goal and allocate or apportion those goals to your subsystems and components that take into consideration things like complexity and the challenges of each component and subsystem during the design and manufacture process, so on and so forth, to come up with these goals to allow these design teams to go away and work independently towards these achievable goals. But the main thrust of my webinar is actually not the allocation activity itself. It's the design, the reliability design cycle, where you start off with goals which are useful, not perfect. They can never be perfect. For them to be perfect, you need to have already designed your system, because then you know what it looks like. So you start with useful goals that are allocated to your subsystems and components, and then you go through and actually do something based on what you see and how the performance matches these allocated goals. So one of the things that I think a lot of listeners and readers took away from the webinar, at least from my perspective, it was much more important to focus on the process around allocation than allocation itself. Because if you try and allocate goals that you make as perfect as possible, not only is it not a thing, but you suck the oxygen from your organization when it comes time to doing other reliability things. If they've spent 2 weeks validating and revalidating and researching and then re-researching all the possible technological challenges for their component to come up with this perfect reliability goal for their subsystem, which can never be perfect, they are less likely to pick up the phone when you, Mr. Reliability Engineer, come back later on and say, okay, we need to do something else. And it's for nothing, because these are not perfect goals. So you shouldn't invest as much time as you perhaps historically have, because it takes away from the process itself.
Yeah, very, very well said, Chris. Fred Schenkelberg and I have talked many times about the importance of understanding what decisions you need to make. So the way you're describing this about allocation, I agree with completely, because it can become its own goal, you know, get things perfectly allocated, and that's not going to improve the design or improve the process. It's what you do with it. It's what decisions you make based on it. Let me tell a quick story. When I picked up General Motors Reliability Group, Product Reliability Group, in 1989, the previous person, and he had passed away, and that's why I got that assignment, the reliability group, all they did was allocate. And they used a very simple allocation process based on complexity. And their entire job, and there was about 15 or so of them, was to start at the vehicle level. We used a metric, DPTV, defects per 1,000 vehicles, and allocated down to resistors and bolts and hinges and computers and what have you in the vehicle. And so so they would do all this work to create these models to allocate. Then they'd walk down the hallway and to the door hinge person, design engineer, and say, your reliability target for the new Corvette is 0.2 DPTV. And they'd hand them that number and walk away. And it had absolutely no value at all to the organization, to the design engineer, or to the customer. And so the first thing I realized when I saw what was going on is that knowing how to calculate, because they could do the calculations, assuming, of course, exponential distribution and everything else, which was faulty. They could do the calculations to say what the reliability would be. They could aggregate it all back up into a system reliability model and have beautiful mathematical representation of the vehicle reliability. And it was all pretty much non-value added. And so one of my lessons from that is that knowing how to calculate reliability is important. Knowing how to achieve it is equally or more important. And so I shifted the group onto doing more. We got into FMEAs. We eventually got into HALT or accelerated life testing and other techniques where it's not as easy to calculate reliability, but it was changing the designs to discover the important failure mechanisms and get them prevented. And so I found to be a balance between, and that's another philosophical underpinning, is a balance between understanding how to calculate reliability and understanding how to achieve it. Mm-hmm. And reliability management has to manage that process.
I'm glad you raised that example, Carl, because it introduces a common issue I always come across, and that is the confusion of performance characteristics with performance indicators. So your number of defects per what have you is an indicator. There's obviously a correlation between the number of defects you have and things like reliability performance. So we obviously want to have fewer defects, and because there is that link, but it's not reliability. We can actually, in other applications, we can build fault tolerance systems if that's the cheapest way of going about improving reliability, or any other number of things that can actually improve the thing that matters, which is the performance characteristic. And we sometimes get too caught up in performance indicators. And when we say, hey, that's an indicator, that's not a performance characteristic, you always get pushback in that. People will always point out that, hey, if that indicator is related to this performance characteristic, therefore reducing it is always good. It takes some time to defeat that mindset. Another good example is I was working with an energy distribution organization, and one of their performance measures was the amount of leakage they had in their pipe network, which sounds good. And you always want to reduce the amount of leakage. But the problem is, if their customer base, if their throughput increased, then the amount of leakage increased just because they were distributing more liquid and gaseous products to create energy. So the easiest way to reduce the amount of leakage you were experiencing was to do less business. So it's one example of how an indicator, whilst it
takes you to the wrong place.
Correct. Well, I mean, moving towards a, you know, leakage per unit fluid displaced or something like that, that's a step in the right direction. But we need to know what our indicators are. We need to know what our performance characteristics are. And we need to know which one of those can be somewhat counterintuitive, even if they sound or feel good at the time.
In one of the early DFR classes that I taught, with a hard drive company. Mm-hmm. When we got to the reliability allocation portion, we allocated reliability to product characteristics. And in other words, we got from the system to the subsystem to the component, and then what characteristics of the component are the knobs that need to be turned, and what are the values that they need to be and what is their tolerance, so to speak, that if you achieve that, you're going to get reliability. That was a really useful discussion, case studies, that type of thing. And I've learned from that to, I'll give an example. This is going back earlier in my career. The biggest failure problem that the last framed vehicle that GM made, full framed, separate from unibody, was the Caprice. And the biggest warranty problem they had was front end alignment. Front end alignment is like what you're talking about as an indicator. It's you have to understand what contributes to front end alignment to address it. And so we did different studies, Monte Carlo studies and that type of thing. We found out that there's a specific dimension in one of the knuckles, steering knuckles, that was key to front end alignment, but it was not even called out on the drawing. It was not a product characteristic that had special control. And so when we identified it as a product characteristic, put it under control, both in design to get the right values and tolerances and manufacturing to achieve it, front end alignment started going down as a problem. So I think there's a huge discussion that the reliability community should have, and that fits exactly what you're talking about, which is to get to the characteristics, not just to the indicators or the higher level metrics.
And to be clear, indicators are, we need indicators. We can't be in a world where we, don't have indicators. People need to know,
right,
at a granular level what they're supposed to do or what good work looks like. We just need to continually remind ourselves that indicators are themselves not characteristics. If things change, understand what we're trying to achieve, or make sure everyone knows what the end goal is, the strategic vision is. So if they find a way of doing something that's better, they're not hamstrung by having to always focus on indicators. But I suppose we better wrap this conversation up, Carl. Have we concluded anything monumental, or is this an ongoing ramble?
No, I was thinking about that. This would be fun to do a part two or a part three as time goes on, and because there's so much to the subject. But I do like the format, which is, let's just talk about what works, what doesn't work, things that are most important on managing reliability programs, because everybody, even the geekiest reliability person who is just an outstanding at doing the different models and work that they do, everybody is going to have to see where they fit into reliability management, because it's reliability management that brings that skill together in the right way, like you said, Chris, with the vital few methods and the vital few failure modes, to achieve the reliability strategic vision. So it's a subject that we can all learn from, and we would love to hear from listeners as to what works for you on reliability management or reliability programs. So feel free to be in touch with us, and we'll make sure that we include in the show notes. Now, you may know it by heart, Chris. If not, we'll put it in the show notes of how you reach us with that kind of feedback.
Well, there's a comments box at the bottom of the podcast. If you're able to type your thoughts in straight away, we always read them. And your thoughts are always front and center for our ongoing brainstorming sessions for what the next topic should be. So please use those comments box. We always review them. And beyond that, looking forward to speaking to you all soon. Thank you for your time, Carl.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.